This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
During July, the Union of Sailors, with the support of activists, anarchists, and communists, blocked containers with military steel for Israeli war purposes in Piraeus port.
A Greek teacher reports on protests against Zionist Israeli tourists on Crete.
And then next thing I know, they sent 7 authorities and they threw me to the ground. And that's when they put their knee in my back, they twisted my arms behind my back. And 3 men on each side levitated me while one was pulling my hair and my chains.
Former Amazon Labor Union President Chris Smalls calls out the Israeli Offense Force, U.S. labor officials, and liberal politicians and media after he was beaten, arrested, and detained by the Israeli military for attempting to bring aid to starving Palestinians in Gaza.
Julian Assange asked, "What is the average death count of the typical Western journalist?" And that's the death count that we'll learn from Gaza for Fox News, for NBC News, for CNN, for the Washington Post, for the New York Times, and all of these enemies of the people. Shame on them! Shame!
Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal condemns corporate media's coverage of Gaza at a rally outside the Capitol Hill offices of Fox News and NBC. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. The growing movement against the U.S.-supported Israeli genocide in Gaza and the pogroms in the West Bank has led to mass protests by Greek teachers and workers on Crete. Calliope Svarna, a communist and teacher on Crete, spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about Greek anger, about the genocide, and about Israeli Zionist tourists attacking shops because they display posters supporting Palestine.
The last few months, the movement for free Palestine has been growing rapidly here in my country. Over the last few weeks, in 3 Greek islands, in Syros, Rhodes, and Crete, and specifically in Agios Nikolaos town, major protests have taken place in order to demonstrate against the dockage of the cruise ship Crown Iris, which is bringing Israeli tourists in Greek islands for leisure during the ongoing tragic genocide. Unfortunately, the schools are closed here, but a lot of people, sensitive and conscious people of all ages, from children to elderly, activists, members of trade unions like teachers, extra-parliamentary communist parties, such as the Communist Liberation, in which I belong, anarchists, the Greek-Palestinian community, the initiative March to Gaza in Greece, the initiative BDS of Greece, have organized all these mobilizations.
And these tourists that come from Israel, does that include IDF members, people in the military in Israel?
Yes, they are Zionists. They destroy people's stores as far as they support Palestine. They are Zionists, and they manifested it. We do not want murderers of innocent children in Greece. In addition, recently we have read that the 87% of the people of Israel, the majority, are in favor of the Palestinian genocide. There are no excuses. There is no minority who, these tourists are not the minority who support Palestinians. All Israeli people who support Palestinians are under suppression or are in prison. They are in prison. They are not in a cruise ship in the Greek islands, of course.
So when these protests take place, how do they take place? And do they try to stop you from protesting, the police, the government?
Yes, we were confronted with hard suppression. We were forbidden to march at the harbor and throughout the city of Agios Nikolaos, despite our constitutional rights to freedom of speech and movement being violated, since the police attacked us with chemicals without provocation while we were peacefully assembled on a central road. Our message was sent loud and clear. In addition, during July, the Union of Sailors, with the support of activists, anarchists, and communists, blocked containers with military steel for Israeli war purposes in Piraeus Port. We have a hard suppression in all these cases, but we're not going to stop. We're not going to stop.
And what do the Israeli tourists do that has offended the people in Greece? You said that they act in a way that is disrespectful of the Greek people?
In many cases, they have manifested the symbols of their country. They have ejected swords against us. They were yelling at us that they are fond of Turkey. And they destroy at the stores where there are clear signs that they are in favor of Palestinians.
Oh, so in other words, they attack the stores where the store owners have symbols in support of the Palestinian struggle. So they target supporters in Greece of Palestine.
Yes. Yesterday, we have an incident in Agios Nikolaos town. His mast in a store, and he was very violent towards people inside the store.
What did he do?
He smashed things, and he wanted to do harm to the people who were inside, the Greeks, who were in favor for Palestinians.
So he's trying to intimidate the Greek people who are in favor of Palestine.
We were bullied in the harbor of Agios Nikolaos by the Israeli tourists. We were bullied. They didn't want us to have a Palestinian signs at all.
And what has been the reaction of people in Greece to these Zionist attacks?
We Greeks do not stand with the Greek government, not with a major part of Greek capitalists who maintain close partnership with Israeli capital in the field of economy. These tourists probably are soldiers that the Israel state offered them a travel for leisure after they did what they did in Palestine. We have data for this, like Nazis who were traveling after what they did.
And what is the role of the Greek government? I mean, Israel has been accused and is in trial for committing genocide. It's massacring the Palestinian people. It's committing a pogrom in the West Bank. It's the support of the United States. The U.S. government is helping this genocide and pogroms. What is the role of the Greek government in relationship to this genocide?
Traditionally, Greece had good relationship with the Arabs, but the last 15 years, this situation has changed radically. According to the report of the Office of Economic and Commercial Affairs of the Greek Embassy in Tel Aviv on the economy of Israel and the development of economic and commercial relationships between Greece and Israel, we have many numerous top examples of important Israeli companies that have invested or have synergies with private or government agencies in Greece, in many sectors, in the sectors of real estate, in sector of industry of tourism, and in we have a very close military collaboration. I have many examples to refer to you in many fields. For example, Greek Air Force has been trailing Israeli pilots in the military base of Kalamata in southern Greece. Israeli companies which construct weapons have bought out Greek ones. Greek refineries export gas oil to Israel. Also, about 10,000 Israeli people have obtained the so-called golden visa by purchasing real estate in very high prices in Greece, which grants them free movement in Greece as if they were Greek citizens. These people who are guilty of the ongoing genocide have a certain shelter in our country, should the war get worse for the Israel. Also, in the days of the brief Israel-Iran war, critical Israeli air forces, along with the presidential vessel, were here present in Greece. So our country is not just supportive of Israel in the Palestinian war of genocide. It also offers the necessary strategic depth that it does not have in the case of a full war escalation. We're talking about a very close military collaboration. Very close, very, the relationships are very deep. As far as the energy is concerned, it's interesting that the Greek bourgeois considers that it will ensure the exclusive support of Greece on the USA against Turkey, simply by pointing out that Turkey will drill itself through a state company. As far as we're talking about the extractions of Mediterranean Sea, the undersea deposits, while Greece will give the lion's share from the deposits to Chevron, to the American Chevron, American company Chevron, and other sisters companies. We have a harsh competition on the sector of energy between Turkey on the one hand and on the other hand, the bourgeoisie of Israel, Cyprus, Egypt, and Greek bourgeoisies. We have a harsh competition on the energy.
And the government of Greece, they still support relations with Israel. So Israel has an embassy and normal relations with Greece.
Not normal relationships, exceptional relationships. It's outstanding, the investments in tourism and real estate, direct investments from Israel capital in Greek real estate, reaches about 700 million euros. This data is from 2022.
And that's a big amount of money in Greece.
Yes, that's why, of course, if we want to say, if we want to speak truth, Greek government aligns with the USA government and the leaders of the European Union, because Israel couldn't afford this war without the strong support of the government of USA and the leaders of the European Union, of course.
And the Greek government apparently is also militarily arming. The United States is demanding that other governments around the world, pro-U.S. governments, increase their military spending to 5%. Is the United States doing the same thing in Greece, demanding the militarization in Greece?
Of course, because almost all the Greece have American bases, especially in Crete. We have a base, a military base in Suva. We have in Larissa, in Settle Greece. We have in Kalamata, southern Greece. We have in Alexandroupolis, near the borders with Turkey. All Greece have been transported to an American military base.
And what do the people of Greece think about these military bases, U.S. military bases in Greece?
They don't feel safe anymore. They don't feel safe for being an ally to the United States of America. They are very afraid of what will happen in the American bases in Crete in case of the war gets worse. They want the bases out of the country, out of the country. We don't want bases. We have demonstrated against the American military base in Greece every year. Every year, we are protesting in Suva.
And are the unions active? Is the Education Teachers Union active in opposition to bases, opposition to the war, and opposition to the genocide?
Yes, especially the trade unions, the primary trade unions, who are in the base of the teachers and very close to the students. High-level, upper-level unions, trade unions of teachers, are more bureaucratical. They are very indifferent to the genocide. The primary trade unions are more energetic, and they organize a major protests against the genocide of Palestinians.
That was teacher Calliope Sfarna on mass protests against Israeli Zionist tourists on the Greek island of Crete.
Μικρή μου ρε μονιά μου, μα η ρε μονιά περαιχτήκα. Σάρω μοιράσει πέφτει για ένα κρανθί ρε μόνα να δω, να με ποδώσει κρέφτη. Έλα, έλα, μικρή μου ρε μονιά μου. Λένε ομορφιές του κόσμου μου όσοι δεν εγνωρίζανε τα δυο σου μάτια φως μου. Έλα, έλα, μικρή μου λεμονιά μου. Έλα, έλα, μικρή μου λεμονιά μου, δεν τρύπωσε καμαρώνα. Καθημερινή και σχόλη και θα γυρέσει χρόνο σου σε ξένο περιβόλι. Έλα, έλα, μικρή μου λεμονιά μου.
Μικρή μου λεμόνια μου. Cretan Music. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Former Amazon Labor Union President Chris Smalls has returned to the United States after he was beaten, arrested, and detained by the Israeli military for attempting to bring aid to starving Palestinians in Gaza on board the Freedom Flotilla. He spoke to Sabrina Salvati, host of the Savvy Sabs podcast.
Yeah, you know, I'm just connecting the dots. You know, Amazon has U.S. Amazon Web Services is Israel's Iron Dome, essentially, and their military and industrial intelligence is participating in the surveillance and targeting of innocent Palestinians with that technology. And they invested $7.2 billion, which is called the Project Nimbus, along with other corporations. So they're absolutely connected to this struggle. And for me as a labor leader, as you mentioned, my goal is to apply pressure to other labor unions who haven't passed zero resolutions since October 7th, and still continue to ship arms and manufacture weapons for Israel.
That's what exactly happened when they boarded the ship?
Just like the Madeleine, they come in the middle of the night. They what people saw up until the point where they pulled the cameras down. They cut communications off from the rest of the world. They don't want everybody to see this. And basically, they detained us until we arrived at the port of immigration, a port of Assad, in the morning. For about 12 hours, we had to stay on deck with our hands up or pretty much sleep uncomfortable until we arrived at the port to be transferred over to the port authorities. They announced that they were getting on board, not to move or, you know, keep your hands up. They even announced and acknowledged that we were on a hunger strike, surprisingly. They couldn't do their propaganda. They actually came on with a camera crew. They wanted to take pictures like they did with Greta with sandwiches and water, but they knew that we were on a hunger strike. So they announced that, and that killed that propaganda. But they still were eager, trying to give us food throughout the night, trying to offer us water, but we didn't accept it. And once we were transferred over to the authorities at immigration, the same thing. They met us at the docks with a camera crew right there. No, we always detained until we were transferred over to immigration. And from there, we get in process to be either deported or if you elect to go see the judge, that's going to send you to prison. So I believe 14 of us decided that we were going to see the judge and the other 7 were deported immediately. When we got to the dock, the IOF, they transferred us over one by one to the immigration. They called us off by countries. They left the Americans for last. There were 7 of us. But I was one of the last to get off. I might have been like second or third from last. And as I was walking towards the building, they had all these cameras in our faces. So I cursed them out pretty much, saying that I don't consent to any of these cameras and pictures. I covered my face. And then next thing I know, they sent 7 authorities and they threw me to the ground. And that's when they put their knee in my back, they twisted my arm behind my back,
and three men on each side levitated me while one was pulling my hair and my chains, choking me to the point where I couldn't move. And at the same time he was choking me, he was telling me to shut up repeatedly. Then they brought me into a separate room away from the rest of the crew members. I was isolated and I was guarded by five guards the entire time throughout the entire process. So they didn't want me to interact or speak or anything the entire time until I was transferred over to prison.
Max Blumenthal said that the Israelis are incredibly racist, even to the Ethiopians that live in Israel.
Yes, I can attest to that. The prison that we was in was full of Ethiopians. They didn't want us to see. They had us isolated from them. They put a curtain up or a wall, a barrier up every day. We were at the last two cells. But we saw as we walked through, you know, I know I paid attention to who was in there, and it was full of Ethiopians and full of Filipinos as well.
There were Filipinos there?
Yeah. Yep. That actually was.
So, Chris, like some of the treatment that you described from the IDF, I would say is similar to the treatment that the NYPD has given towards people in New York. And there is a relationship there, for those who are not aware, where a lot of these police officers have been trained by the IDF. So the same type of terror that you see abroad, you see that here in the United States as well. What has the reception been like from local politicians? Have you heard anything from, for example, Zoran Mandami, AOC, any of the New York politicians? Have they reached out to you?
No, absolutely not. You know, they choose to ignore it, but it's okay. You know, I mean, I think people notice that. And it's a shame, but I always say this, that politicians will never be our saviors. So it didn't matter whether they reached out or not. You know, I already know how far their help is going to go or support. And I always know that the community is what matters most. We have to save ourselves. So, you know, the work that we're doing is directly affecting people every day. You know, it's not going to be our politician.
I agree with you there. Were you surprised that AOC and Bernie Sanders in particular, who came out after you won the unionization for Amazon, have said nothing?
No, I mean, I guess I rubbed them the wrong way. So, you know, it is what it is with me. I'm not the average union president that just endorsed Democrats. I've been very vocal about my opposition on their politics, especially being pro-Palestine from the very beginning. We don't align, so it is what it is. They choose to ignore it, and that's fine. But it just shows people who they really are, you know, and I hope people see that. And there's no sugarcoating. Like I said, everybody, unless he was under a rock, everybody knew or got a wind of what's going on, especially with my captivity. So there's no way they have no excuse for it, but, you know, I'll let the people decide what to do with that.
Yeah, we definitely all saw, we are all aware. What would you say to, if you could speak to other union leaders like Sean Fain, for example, what would you say to him about the pro-Palestine movement?
Well, I know he's been disrupted before by his own rank and file about that. So I wouldn't really have to say much, you know. Really, I would say more of, I don't agree with the fact that he agrees with Trump's tariffs that caused 30,000 union members in Canada to lose their jobs. So that's what I would say. And then I will also, you know, I encourage his rank and file members and any rank and file member of all of these unions that have been complicit to do something about it. You know, everybody has an opportunity right now to play a role in this fight. And now they are very aware of what's going on. And we got to hold the unions accountable who have been very complicit or participating. It's just that simple.
I totally hear you. And I do want to make this announcement for those who have not seen. This is from Sarah Wilkerson. She said 44 countries will launch the largest civilian flotilla of ships in an effort to challenge the illegal Israeli blockade, and then another and then another. Chris, I'm sure you've heard about this. How do you feel about it that more countries, more people want to stand up and step up and volunteer?
That's what we need. You know, that's exactly what we need. I'm happy to be a part of the coalition. And, you know, in the future, I'll be able to join another mission. You know, I'm not one and done. And, you know, I'm wishing them the best of luck. And I hope that they break their legal shoes that Israel has imposed.
because enough is enough. We have to do it now.
Right. We do have to do it now. Another question that I had for you. I saw in an interview before you went on the Hondola, you said that you didn't want your kids to grow up in a world or the world like it is today. I'm sure your kids are very proud of you.
Yeah, they are. You know, they're at that age where they are definitely paying attention to everything around them and worldly events. And, you know, they were the first phone call I made when I got back home. I didn't get to see them yet because I did contract scabies and I want to be on the safe side. So I had to get that taken care of. But I'm looking forward to hugging them again. That's everything that I look forward to when I was in prison.
What would you say, like some of the things that you saw, the solidarity there on the Hondola? You have people from all different countries. I believe 7 Americans there. What would you say about that solidarity?
Oh, man, when you live with these people on the water, on an open graveyard where, you know, one mistake can kill everybody. It's a special type of bond. And definitely family oriented. We had the grandmother of the ship, Vigis, who was 70, who I attached myself to and even protected while she was while we was in captivity. You know, it was things like that, moments like that that got us through together. We had to build a special bond in the family because we were going into a life or death situation where we know in the past they've killed, you know, 10 activists. So to go into that, we all had to be on a certain level, and we are.
And the fact that the IDF soldiers came, when they got on the boat, they tried to give all of you food, just goes to show you how easily they could give food to people in Gaza, but they're choosing not to. Netanyahu has made a recent announcement that he is going to, or Israel is going to occupy all of Gaza, which I believe was the plan from the get-go prior to October 7th. They wanted this to happen. What do you say to people back home, Chris? What do you say to people in New York that may not be as focused on this issue or may say, well, it's foreign policy, it's over there, it's not happening here?
Well, I would say that's just that's smoke and mirrors, because everything that's happened in foreign policy obviously is affecting us here at home, especially if our taxpaying dollars, you know, billions of dollars is going towards this genocide when we're over here struggling, living check to check. Meanwhile, the folks over there, Israel, they get universal health care. They get to go to college for free. And that's off of our expenses. There's no way that people shouldn't be outraged. And on top of that, you know, we have to escape the two-party system. I mean, these last elections have proven, once again, how there's a disconnect between the working class and our government. And it's not going to be our government that's going to correct it. It's going to be the people. So I'm hoping that with this mission, with the Hondola and future missions, that we continue to spread awareness, especially to American citizens who money is going towards this genocide.
That's right. I know we've been criticizing the two-party system for quite some time. And speaking of that, I'm curious. You mentioned one time before when you were on RBN about the Labor Party. Do you think we need a Labor Party in the U.S.?
Absolutely. I mean, I see what my brother Jeremy Corbyn is doing. He already endorsed me with my Labor Party. I endorse him with his Your Party. And I was absolutely happy and floored when I came home and I saw that the numbers on my Labor Party page has quadrupled. So I know that people are looking for a home. And that's something that I'm going to be working hard for to build over the next 2 or 3 years so we can get it on the ticket for 28.
You started to, you know, announce your support for Gaza. What happened after that?
Oh, it's a wave of cancel culture, so to speak. You know, I didn't get booked for the entire year with speaking engagements. I lost, you know, opportunities that I probably wouldn't even imagine. And I lost tens of thousands of followers overnight, whether it's Twitter, Instagram, a combination of the both. Yeah, that was right in the beginning.
Yeah, that's what I think some people may not realize. Like you stood to lose a lot, right? But you did it anyway. And I think a lot of people wouldn't have taken that chance. They would just been like, oh, I'm just going to be silent on this issue.
I agree. Yeah, that's another conversation. It's just like, you know, even though it's focused on me, I always want to point it back to the Palestinian people. What I experienced was just a fraction of it. You know, I can't imagine what they're going through. And that's what the real story should be, is that these people are out there suffering every day. And the world is watching. We have to figure out something immediately.
That was Amazon Labor Union founder Chris Smalls speaking on the Savvy Sabs podcast.
There is a word in Arabic, sumud. It means steadfast perseverance. Particularly in resistance to the occupation of your homeland. I just want that thing. When voices join in harmony, and in that fleeting moment, when meaning coalesces there, dark dissolving, clouds the alleyways no more. And fresh bread, scent of home, pervades the air. No sandaled soles in dust of broken homes peep bloody from the garment hem. And all the big parades and shock and awe and swagger on the carrier deck, and medals jangle helpless in the face of what is fair. Give me an oh yeah.
Roger Waters singing Samud, a new song released this year. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. On August 6th, at a rally outside the Capitol Hill offices of Fox News and NBC, Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal blasted corporate media as enemies of the people for manufacturing consent for the Gaza genocide and demonizing independent and Palestinian journalists.
I'm speaking here on behalf of those of us in the West, in independent media, who were prematurely correct. We were wrongly correct. We were right before it was allowed. We were right that CNN was lying when they put up on a chyron that
40 babies had been beheaded by Hamas. We were right when right-wing Zionist journalists started claiming that Hamas had baked babies in ovens on October 7th, citing fraudulent rescue organizations like Zaka and United Hatzalah. We were right when we called out the New York Times for its phony front page investigation, claiming that Palestinian resistance groups on October 7th committed mass rape against Jewish women. They never produced any survivors. They never produced any forensic evidence. They never produced any credible police investigations. They never produced anything to the point where they had to change the entire definition. And the New York Times never even corrected its piece when virtually all of its eyewitnesses were proven to be frauds. What they do correct, though, and issue a clarification on, is that an emaciated child, Mohammed Zakaria Al-Mutawakk, who is living in a tent with his mother, whose father was killed on the beach in Gaza City, who suffers from a muscular condition, who cannot get enough milk, which worsens his muscle condition, they issued a correction, noting that that child had a pre-existing condition, caving to Zionists who accused the New York Times of an anti-Semitic blood libel for showing that child on the front page. Because what? What? We're supposed to accept the death of the Untermenschen? That's what they're claiming, and the New York Times caves to them, but made no correction on any of these phony investigations which we exposed. We also exposed Israel's killing of hundreds of its own citizens on October 7th through the Hannibal Directive. And for these exposés, for being prematurely correct, we at the Gray Zone were attacked not once, but twice in feature-length articles by the billionaire-owned Washington Post, which falsely accused us of being funded by Russia and Iran. The Washington Post is an enemy of the people. And we were attacked by Haaretz, not once, not twice, not three times, but four times, the supposed voice of the liberal, enlightened, peace-loving public of Israel. For being prematurely right, then what did Haaretz do? They turn around and declare, oh, wait a minute, we have uncovered copious evidence that Israel fired on dozens and dozens of vehicles on October 7th containing Jewish Israeli citizens, and that it had free fire orders to open fire everywhere and actually enacted a mass Hannibal directive. But they never said the independent media was right. No. Why was this? How can we understand this dynamic? What was taking place in the days and the weeks and the months after October 7th was the media was fulfilling its traditional role, the corporate media, in manufacturing consent for genocide, in manufacturing consent for war. And once they had finally gotten the public to go along with it or to shut down or to be afraid of challenging their lies, and the Israeli genocide machine was cranked into full gear, destroying northern Gaza, pushing the population south, moving into Rafah for that destruction, and we were warning, this is a genocide, full Auschwitz is coming next. Then they could start admitting that some of the narratives that they had spun out were incorrect, because the damage had already been done. It is always that way with the corporate media and their retroactive morality. And that's why they and the members of the Democratic Party are now finally starting to acknowledge that Israel might be doing some Nazi-like things in Gaza, like deliberately starving people to death. But they're barely even acknowledging that. Look at this New York Times headline from last month. Gaza residents are starving. They're just hungry. I don't know who could possibly be starving them. It's just like the headline that they pumped out in January 2024. Violence breaks out at Gaza aid site. That's where Israel massacred dozens of people seeking flour at an aid site in northern Gaza. They've been starving people for months and years now. Oh, violence just broke out. It was like a Jerry Springer show. Let's bring out the bodyguards because the DNA test showed that the baby's daddy was actually not the husband. The New York Times has referred to schools that were bombed housing war refugees as ex-schools, like the school transitioned. Like it's not a school anymore, and its new pronouns are Hamas Command and Control Center. Don't dead name the school. This is the ridiculous language that we have come to expect from a newspaper that is mobbed up with hardcore Zionists, including its executive editor, Joe Kahn, whose father was a member of CAMRA, the Israel Lobby censorship group. Not one, not two, not three, but four current and recent members of the New York Times team in the Jerusalem Bureau had children in the Israeli army. Ethan Bronner, Isabel Kirshner, the current bureau chief, Myra Novick, and then David Brooks, the columnist. David Brooks' son participated in the pilot program for this genocide in 2014. Can you imagine if, a Palestinian journalist at the New York Times had a child who was in the resistance, what would happen to them? They'd be out the door so fast, they would never work again. But these people are proud of it. And where do they work in Jerusalem? They work in the ethnically cleansed home of Hassan Karmi, who ran the BBC's Arabic news service and was kicked out of his home at gunpoint in the Katamon quarter of Jerusalem by Zionist militias. That home was purchased by Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, in the 1980s. They literally work out of an ethnically cleansed home. And that's not a scandal? The media has fulfilled its role. The corporate media has fulfilled its role as an enemy of the people and an ally of the military, industrial complex, and the national security state. Their traditional role is whenever they care about humanitarian suffering in another country like Libya or Syria or Ukraine, it's because they want us to wage war on an official enemy. And so we saw them in Libya crank up lies about Gaddafi's forces being given Viagra to commit mass rape against the opposition in order to get NATO into military action to destroy an African country and destabilize a region, cause a migrant crisis, and destabilize the whole Sahel. Same thing in Syria. CNN even sent a reporter, Arwa Damon, to a refugee camp to sniff a backpack to prove that a chemical attack had occurred in order to trigger US and British military action. But the backpack sniffers and the liars and the stenographers for power have been an essential part of the Holocaust of our time. And now we see that what's happening in Gaza, the killing of probably hundreds of thousands. We're gonna find out that there are hundreds of thousands of excess deaths if this ever ends, because now Israel's talking about fully occupying Gaza. We're gonna find out that this is a Holocaust worse than we ever imagined. And they have been an important part of manufacturing consent. What we are witnessing and what we all know is that this is actually a textbook case for military intervention. That this is the time to bomb the railways to Auschwitz. This catastrophe, this nightmare, this Holocaust, this genocide truly demands military intervention. And the media is just sitting on its hands. They don't even want to go in. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is the logical, predictable outcome of so many responsibility to protect humanitarian interventionist frauds that have been perpetrated by the media. That's what this is. It's just another humanitarian fraud designed to cause death, which is backed by the CIA and the Mossad. A literal CIA agent, Phil Riley, is running this. And Phil Riley, it should be subjected to Nuremberg 2.0 if he's ever found. But the media, what they should be doing now, how they could actually recover their reputation, is they should go to Rafah, set up media tents, get out of their air-conditioned offices, and demand entry to Gaza. Because I was just in touch with a doctor. Yes, I was just in touch with a doctor from Gaza yesterday. And you know what he told me, which is so depressing? He said, we need to get some reporters in there, but not Arabs or Muslims, because no one believes us. No one believes the heroes of our time who have been targeted by Israeli drones and assassination death squads, who have had their heads literally blown off while doing their jobs. And so it's up to them, and they're failing on the job. If they were in Gaza now, there is no way they would be able to ignore what we see, and it would shut this whole operation down. And you know why I think they're not doing it? Because when you shut this genocide down, you start to set Israel on a path to its own destruction. Because as Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli leadership have clearly said, this assault on Gaza is existential for them. And so they will keep it going for as long as possible until we intervene. Julian Assange asked, what is the average death count of the typical Western journalist? And that's the death count that we'll learn from Gaza for Fox News, for NBC News, for CNN, for the Washington Post, for the New York Times, and all of these enemies of the people. Shame on them. For shame. 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 Shame.
That was Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal speaking at a rally against Fox News and NBC outside their Capitol Hill offices.
Do you all know fake news? Do you know fake news? Do you know fake news, man? Everywhere I go in Europe for the last 2 years and America, everybody's crazy about this. Everybody's losing their goddamn minds. Fake news, fake news, fake news. Fake news. Relax, everybody. Take it easy. Calm down, man. You see, in the motherland where I'm from, we have been under fake news for 400 years, man. Welcome to the party. Yeah. This is Sheu Anukulagokuti reporting live from Lagos, Nigeria, West Africa, for the Black Times, everybody.
Black Times, Seyun Kuti live performance at the Montreux Jazz Club. San Francisco mime, troupe, playwright, and actor Michael Sullivan addresses gentrification and billionaire politicians in his new play, Disruption. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
The whole period that we're in, do you find it shocking that the United States at this point has a fascist government?
I wish I could say it was shocking. I mean, one of the things that the Mime Troupe said, one of the reviews was like, the Mime Troupe should just name our show, We Told You So. You know, we've been talking about creeping fascism in the cycle of governments, in the cycle of economics, how people, capitalism failed decades ago. You know, it failed in the Depression, really. It failed at the Great Crash. And has been propped up with these different things ever since, different government programs that are essentially socialist programs to try to keep capitalism going. And I feel like the capitalists started feeling like, no, this really works, actually, you know, knowing that they forgetting that they were resting on public wealth, resting on democracy and Republican, a democratic republic. They were resting on all of this and just becoming more and more selfish, more and more a commitment to profit first. So what we're seeing now, in my opinion, is, as they said, you know, Mussolini almost called fascism corporatism. The idea that what we have are people, I was talking to somebody yesterday about this, this commitment of, well, business is so wonderful that what we need is to run our governments like a business. If only we get business people in there, without understanding that business, capitalism, is antithetical to democracy, and government is a not-for-profit service organization. When you put corporate people in charge of a not-for-profit organization, they don't understand it. They're looking for profit. And in my opinion, our current president-like object is not thinking of becoming a dictator. He's thinking of being a CEO. CEOs only have to answer to the board that they picked. So he doesn't understand government on a fundamental level as a service organization. And he has surrounded himself with other people who see it as a corporation. And it really should be this great example of how bad capitalism is when you put pure capitalists in charge and they ruin everything because they don't see us. At best, we're customers if we have the money. And if we don't have the money to be customers, we should just be outside the store. We can't afford anything. Get out. Die. And on top of that, there's the raging racism, the horrifying sexism, the neo-Confederate quality, you know, all of that bound together in a government that is neither of, by, or for the people in any way whatsoever. And all I had to do was write a comedy about that, even with our current mayor. And it's like, oh, yeah, he ran a nonprofit. People forget. He inherited a bunch of money. You know, this idea that multimillionaires can solve our problems. He doesn't have a history of a real public service. He inherited hundreds of millions of dollars. And he turned around and started appointing people from Silicon Valley whose primary skill was raising money. And from my perspective, I don't know Mr. Lurie, so I don't know if he's a sexist or racist or anything else. All I know is he, like Donald Trump and Elon Musk, hasn't had to work for anybody. He hasn't had to take an order. He hasn't had to have his work reviewed. And so on the one hand, we've got somebody who has never had to really work their way up to do anything, can just buy things, appointing Silicon Valley sociopaths to be in charge of the public good. There's a lot of similarity between what that happening in San Francisco, and there are a lot of people here who will say, well, I hate Trump and Musk, oh, but they love these people. And it's like, but they're not as bad, I don't think, but they're on the same path. We need actual public servants. Started really like back in the 80s when Dianne Feinstein wanted to make San Francisco the financial capital of the Pacific Rim. And so she gave all these huge tax cuts to, you know, Bank of America and Wells Fargo and all of these companies to put their headquarters here. It didn't work. They moved to Shanghai or they moved anywhere else in the country. And so we had this tradition of giving these tax breaks to anybody who says they'll build something in San Francisco. And the pattern normally goes about the same. They say, we will build luxury condominiums, but we'll balance that out by building affordable housing. But we'll build the luxury stuff first. They build that, and then they always say, oops, we ran out of money before they get to the affordable housing. Or like with Newsom's new bill, which is, as I understand it, if you're building affordable housing, you have a lot of environmental regulations and you're using union workers. But if you're building luxury condos, you're exempt from those. And they say, oh, you don't have to use union workers. First of all, you should always have to use union workers. That isn't an option. But they're giving the luxury housing market a pass and saying, well, this is all about creating new housing. There's plenty of housing in San Francisco. It's underutilized. There are all of these useless buildings that they built for corporations that are standing empty that should be converted. It's always trickle down. Every time somebody comes up with a plan and tries to enact a plan for housing or to help local organizations and businesses and nonprofits, there's always this part that says, first, we're going to help the ruling class. Don't worry, we'll get to you. But first, we're going to make sure corporations have nice, shiny headquarters. First, we're going to make sure that there are luxury condominiums. First, we're going to do all this. Then eventually that will take pressure off of the housing market or something. And it's like, no, that just means that the ultra rich will own two houses. That just means that you'll build these condos downtown and say, oh, well, don't worry. Rich people will move into those condos and that will open up housing. No, those rich condos will be owned by people who don't even live here. They will be second vacation homes for people from Seattle, from Washington, from Denver, from DC, from New York. There's no law that says you have to live here to own them. So a lot of those buildings are empty, not because the property isn't owned, but because the people don't live there. Having some regulation about local ownership would help much more than just building more luxury sky-high houses.
That was San Francisco mime, troupe, playwright, and actor Michael Sullivan on his new play, Disruption. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, Ann Garrison, and Polina Vasiliev. You'll find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.